A new border crisis today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump is threatening to close the border with Mexico next week. We'll get the latest from Texas. Also, 2 weeks after Christchurch, mosques and other houses of worship re-examine their security.
At the end of the day, this isn't about anti-Semitism. It's not about Islamophobia. Each of our congregations have been attacked. This is about white supremacy.
Plus, British politicians fail to agree on a Brexit solution again.
I can tell the politicians this. Judgment Day will come because the election will come.
And freedom of speech worries as the EU cracks down on copyright violations.
And there definitely is a potential for impact on open internet and freedom of speech.
It's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for joining us this Friday. As we head into the weekend, think about this from President Trump today. In a series of tweets, the president threatened to close the southern border, or large sections of it, quote, if Mexico doesn't immediately stop all illegal immigration coming into the United States through our southern border, end quote. Trump's threat comes just 2 days after immigration officials warned that they're at the breaking point. Angela Kachurga reports on border issues from El Paso, Texas. What is the situation right there at that spot on the border, Angela?
Well, we have two things going on. I mean, this is where the CBP commissioner came to say that the breaking point had arrived, and it was being felt most acutely here along the stretch of border of El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, where we have thousands of migrant families coming through asking for asylum. And so Customs and Border Protection officers have been reassigned to help Border Patrol process some of the migrants who are coming through. So we have 750 officers from across the border who are now being reassigned in these key areas like El Paso to help with the migrant families.
Trump has not yet followed through on his threats to actually close the border. But what if he did? What would that look like in a place like El Paso?
Well, trade is critical to this area. El Paso and the surrounding, what we call the borderplex area, Las Cruces, Ciudad Juarez, these communities depend on each other heavily. Locally, I mean, we have more than $87 billion in trade that goes back and forth. And of course, nationwide, more than $600 billion U.S.-Mexico trade. And this is a key entry point. It's not just impacting locally, but a lot of the trade goes back and forth, manufacturing, other types of activity. And we also have lots of people, consumers, shoppers from Mexico who come across into our border communities, our border cities, and they're a critical part of this border economy. They spend dollars and pesos on this side of the border in the U.S. and go back into Mexico, and that would be drastically impacted.
And is your sense from reading Trump's tweets that all border traffic would be stopped if he goes through with this?
It's really hard to predict whether it will even be carried out. I mean, it was done very, very briefly in Tijuana, as you know, when there was concern about migrants trying to, you know, rush through the ports of entry to ask for asylum. Closing it down, even for a short period of time, does have a huge impact. We are already seeing the impact here in the El Paso area because of the reassignment of those customs officers. So they've been pulled off the ports of entry, the official legal entry ports, to do other types of duties, processing migrants. And that means people are, the long lines have started here. We have people waiting 3 hours to come into the country, to go to school, a lot of university students to come to work, executives going back and forth into Mexico for, you know, manufacturing jobs, people coming just to visit relatives. It's a very, very busy weekend ahead. And this is just at the beginning of, I mean, one of the hottest vacation seasons in Mexico is Semana Santa or Holy Week. That's right around the corner. And that's when we have a huge peak in travel cross border.
What have you been hearing from migrants and people who've been coming across the border in recent days?
Well, the issue that we've seen is because there is this so-called metering, the limiting of the number of people who can come through the port and legally ask for asylum, they are basically stuck in Mexico. Mexico is a huge waiting room. People put their names on a list, and if they grow frustrated, some will simply go around the ports of entry and cross, you know, illegally and ask for asylum. All they have to do is step foot on U.S. soil and then make that claim. So we're seeing a lot of people, thousands of people. In one day, on Monday, in fact, we saw more than 1,000 people come through this El Paso area asking for asylum. So the numbers continue to grow, and it really has, it seems to have overwhelmed both Border Patrol and now Customs and Border Protection officers.
What could Trump's tweets actually do to raise kind of the panic level? And people might say, maybe he is going to do this. We better get across fast.
Every single time you hear the president make these comments, these threats, you actually see a spike in the number of people who are making a run for the border, migrants who want asylum, who say, look, I'm not going to take a chance. I'm going to try my luck now. And so if they were even thinking about it, or maybe waiting, they're going to start heading in this direction. And so that actually it spurs more of this migration because people are concerned and they do believe he will carry it out. Of course, in the trade community, there's a lot of concern that this will affect in very real dollars and cents and pesos the economy here on the local level in border cities, but also well beyond that.
Angela Kochergo reports for the Albuquerque Journal. Thanks for your view on this, Angela.
Thank you, Marco.
And why are so many migrant families arriving at the southern border, even as the Trump administration is trying so hard to deter them? We spoke with migrants who just arrived in McAllen, Texas, to find out. You can read that story at theworld.org. I want to spend a couple of minutes remembering someone who died this week, a hero, a pilot for Air France who was leading the crew of a plane that got hijacked in 1976. This was the flight that got commandeered to Entebbe in Uganda by Palestinian and German terrorists. They were aiming to get a number of Palestinian prisoners released who were in Israeli jails. Michel Bakos was the pilot. He died this week at the age of 95. And when I read how he refused to leave the side of the Jewish passengers, even when he was given the chance, that really impressed me. The Israeli raid to free the hostages was ultimately successful.
In Uganda today, the results of Israel's weekend raid to rescue more than 100 hostages from pro-Palestinian hijackers at Entebbe Airport in Uganda. But there were other results, too, from the rescue operation, which has been hailed as audacious and as a blow to terrorists around the world.
Benny Davidson was 13 when he boarded that plane on June 27, 1976, in Athens. You were one of those hostages, Benny, and I remember this whole episode really well in 76. We'd have been about the same age. When you heard the news about Captain Bakos this week, what were your thoughts?
We're very sad to hear the news. We have a small WhatsApp group of the kids of Entebbe. We maintain contact through the years. And one of the group, informed us regretfully that Michel passed away. We knew that he was not well, but still, even at age 95, such a leader and magnificent person passing away brings back a lot of memories that all of us, the kids of Entebbe, share from him.
What do you recall today, and how does Michel Bakos figure into those memories?
I actually remember almost every minute of that horrible week. It took me 40 years to start talking about it. Michel was a tall person and a very handsome person, but his inner personality and his bravery and his leadership was simply out of this world. Michel took over immediately, as a real captain, as a real commander, seeing that everybody gets what their needs, whether blankets, chairs, mattresses, food. During that week, some people became ill. He saw to that that doctors will arrive, medicines will be supplied. He took care of that with the terrorists. He was all over the place taking care of us, and it was a real role model for not just for the kids of Entebbe, but also, I think, for the grown-ups.
I'd like to play, Benny, an excerpt from a documentary that came out in 2000. It's called Operation Thunderbolt, and it's about the raid to free you and the others from the Palestinian and German terrorists who'd hijacked the plane. The voice we're going to hear is Shimon Peres, who was Israeli defense minister at the time.
The minute I heard that the Germans are dividing the passengers between Jews and non-Jews, this was the most emotional moment in my own consideration. Said, my God, you're going to have a small holocaust in this plane.
We're going to have a small holocaust on that plane, so said Shimon Peres about the separation of passengers by the German and Palestinian terrorists in Entebbe. That moment where the pilot, Michel Bakos, decided he's staying Talk about that. I mean, do you remember that moment where he said, the non-Jewish passengers are going back to Paris, but we're staying here?
Yes, definitely. The separation, or what you call separation, we call selection. And selection, you know, in Jewish heritage brings back a lot of memories. It was 1976, 30-odd something years after World War II, and a selection was being made again between Jews, Israelis, and the rest of the world. So as a kid, I remembered the selection stories from the Holocaust. Most of my mother's family was in Poland in the Holocaust. So I saw on the faces of the grown-ups that something meaningful is happening. And, you know, in the Jewish heritage and in the Jewish Bible, there is a very old saying that the Israeli people, the Jewish people, are the chosen ones, the chosen people. During that selection, we were the chosen one to die.
Not in the best sense of chosen by any means.
Yes, yes, actually in the wrong sense, but it is very powerful. We understood what's coming. It was quite grave. And Michel Bakos, on Wednesday, when they started releasing the foreigners, you know, we, the Israelis and the Jews, called the others the foreigners, and he declined, it was a great moment. And saying to the terrorists, bluntly, I'm staying until the last of them, and approached his crew and told them, listen, this is a very grave decision. You can all go home, but you need to decide. He didn't force them to stay. He let them decide by themselves. And everybody, to the last of them, stayed with their captain and their commander and took care of us. And that was extremely impressive. And he never doubted. You know, I spoke with him. He visited Israel many times over the last 43 years. And he said, I didn't even doubt it for a minute. I still have roughly 100 passengers under my control and command, and I'm not leaving them behind without knowing what's happening with them. That was the person. And he did that, you know, with a small smile on his face, not with a grave seriousness on his face.
Well, that really does seem to be the big lesson from Michel Bakos.
If you have another minute, I can add another anecdote, which may be important for the lesson learned.
Please tell me.
So I was traveling with my family, both my parents and my older brother, Ron. And the travel plan was supposed to fly Tel Aviv, Paris, and then we should have been exchanging planes and continuing to New York. And from there, the plan was to do a coast-to-coast trip from East Coast to West Coast in the United States over 3 weeks or a month. That was my bar mitzvah present. Mm-hmm. When we got to Ben Gurion Airport, 1976, we saw that the flight is not Tel Aviv, Paris directly, but Tel Aviv, Athens, Paris. But nevertheless, of course, we boarded it, and the terrorists boarded the plane in Athens.
Right.
And 5 minutes after takeoff in Athens, all hell broke loose, and the story changed. So we got back to Israel. 10 days after, we boarded again a plane, this time direct to New York. And my parents' decision was that we continue with life as planned as soon as possible. And 10 days, that's what it took the Israeli internal office to issue us new passports. And for a month, we did the same coast-to-coast trip that was originally planned for my bar mitzvah. And I think that was a great lesson for me as a kid to learn of how to overcome terror. I call it the Akamol against, or a Tylenol, as you call it in the United States, against terror. I'm not a terror fighter. But if you continue with life and continue with your original plans, that allows you to become mentally safe and healthy. That's my message.
Benny Davidson, one of the hostages aboard the Air France flight that was hijacked to Entebbe, Uganda in 1976. Benny, thanks so much for taking some time to help us remember French pilot Michel Bakos. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up, the Brexit deadline that wasn't, just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In the news business, a deadline is a deadline is a deadline. You hit it or you don't. End of story. Britain, on the other hand, seems to follow a different definition of deadline when it comes to Brexit anyway. Remember, today was supposed to be the day the UK left the European Union? March 29th, it was the deadline to figure out how that would happen. And yet, here we are again with no Brexit plan approved by the British Parliament. Just today, lawmakers rejected for a third time Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan.
Mr. Speaker, I fear we are reaching the limits of this process in this House.
It is totally fair to wonder how anybody is ever going to figure this out. The World's Orla Barry is in London. I'll resort to a baseball metaphor here. Is it three strikes and you're out for Prime Minister May?
Well, I'd like to give you a definitive answer on that, Marco, but I think you should know by now. This is Theresa May we're talking about, and this is Brexit we're talking about. So never say never.
Nothing is clear.
Nothing is clear. We're closer to the cliff edge as we have been edging towards it for the last week and for the last few weeks.
So what now?
Well, there are, once again, and as always, there are a number of options. We still have the option of April 12th, which is the new Brexit date, that being the day that Britain leaves without a deal. But as we know so well, so many people within Parliament and indeed outside in the general public are very much opposed to the idea of leaving without a deal, that the belief is they will do anything to prevent that happening. Once again, of course, that would then depend on the EU saying that they were prepared to accept this kind of new option going forward, and how they would work that out is all up in the air, and it still leaves as many questions as ever.
Yeah, I mean, lawmakers taking these drastic measures and still no deal. I mean, for the British public, this has got to be immensely frustrating.
Intensely frustrating. And in fact, outside Parliament at the moment, if anyone sees the crowds that are outside Parliament, there always are protesters outside Parliament, both leavers and Brexiteers. But today there are thousands upon thousands of leave voters outside Parliament. Today was to be the day that Britain was to leave the EU. So many took the day off and decided they would come to London anyway and protest. And they're extremely frustrated and extremely angry. Have a listen to what some of them had to say.
I think those people need to understand what democracy means and how angry people are the way they've behaved.
The Queen should get involved and tell them, listen, I don't want anarchy on these streets. Give the order and leave.
I can tell the politicians this, Judgment Day will come because the election will come, and those who voted against the people, they will go.
So people who voted to leave there, and they're not getting their way. Of course, there are many, many people who wanted to stay in the European Union, right?
Absolutely. And many of them are also camped outside Parliament. You know, over a million people took to the streets last weekend in London against the idea of leaving the EU. So both sides are together outside the Houses of Parliament, making their voices and their sentiments known to the MPs who are still inside this evening.
Well, fingers crossed for some resolution and for calm. The World's Orla Barry in London, thanks very much and good luck.
Thanks, Marco.
Bikers all know that the freedom, the speed, the excitement of being on a motorcycle is like nothing else. But when only 20% of motorcyclists are women, the entire industry and hobby feels very male. Tiffany Kamhai is a reporter with KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. She's a rider, and she brings us this story about how women are making the biking world their own.
British biker Hayley Bell is tired of feeling like an afterthought. So she put a call out on Facebook to her fellow female riders.
I put out a post to say, I've had a totally crazy idea. Who wants to join me? I'm thinking of doing a world relay and seeing how far we get.
And the Women Riders World Relay was born. Bell, who came up with the idea last fall, says she used Google Translate to post her message in different languages online, thinking maybe it would attract a few hundred women. Over 14,000 women motorcyclists representing more than 90 countries answered the call. Bell says she hopes her crazy idea will grab the attention of the global motorcycle industry.
And move it forwards to include women in a much more equal status than it is at the minute.
Words like that grab 24-year-old Peruvian university student Gianna Velarde. This year, she competed in the Dakar Rally, a grueling 11-day endurance race on her dirt bike, where, she says, a race official was thrown off by her mere presence.
When I asked him if he can give me the road book, he told me, it's only for riders. I show him my bracelet of rider and told him, I'm a rider too. It's because I'm a woman.
Velarde says the man was at a loss for words. She'll be leading part of the South American leg when the relay reaches there in November. And even though the number of women bikers has nearly doubled since a decade ago, things like the apparel and the bikes themselves, Let's just say they've been stuck in a low gear for women. For instance, most bikes are just too tall. I'm 5'1", and only my toes reach the ground on my motorcycle. And that unstable feeling on a machine that easily weighs hundreds of pounds can sometimes be a big obstacle. It's also hard to find protective gear that doesn't make a woman look like the Hulk. That's why Kate Maher created the California Moto Market, a pop-up store that offers hard-to-find women's motorcycle gear.
This is the first time everyone's kind of looking around to say, well, women are people. But they're not really asking the women in the industry how to market to them.
Well, first impressions for me as a rider, just looking around the market, I really like that I didn't see any pink, purple hearts, things with flowers all over them.
Yes. Yeah, no, we're over it. No glitter rhinestones here. Take a tribal butterfly somewhere else.
But it's totally okay if you're into that sort of thing. Now, back to that ride around the world. It recently kicked off in Scotland. Here's founder Hayley Bell again with about half a dozen other women riders on day one.
So it's absolutely gorgeous weather today. It's amazing.
The sun is shining, Scotland is rocking.
Yeah!
Yeah, don't believe them, it's flipping cold.
Bell says she won't be riding the entire relay across the globe, although she'd like to. It's expected to take a year to complete. But Australian motorcyclist Colette Edeline says she's made it her personal goal to complete the entire global event, from Europe and the Middle East to the Pacific Islands and Africa. I got a hold of her when she was still in Britain.
I'm 55. This is never going to happen again, this kind of relay. I just decided, why not?
That means she'll spend almost every day of the next year in the saddle, rain or shine. Sometimes she'll ride with groups of women, but in more remote locations, she could be riding alone. So far, there have been some bumps in the road.
I mean, we rode in snow, we rode in, you know, hail, we rode in the road in absolutely everything in the last 10 days. It's been fantastic. Except very little sun, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you get to the U.S., there will be lots of sun.
Well, that's good. That's good. Lots of Harleys, I hope.
Probably. I'll see her when she gets to California come fall, but not on a Harley. I'll be on my trusty Kawasaki. Until then, I'll be tracking the progress of these women and their machines online as the riders pass a GPS baton along the global relay. For The World, I'm Tiffany Kamhai.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, women tell us about traveling solo.
The men who I was meeting traveling, they would go on treks into the jungle with different local people, of course, mostly men. And that entire part of traveling was off limits to me.
Your travel stories that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
And I'm Lydia Emanuelidou, a producer here at The World. And I'm here to tell you about Article 13. You've heard about this, Marco, right?
All week long I've been hearing about it and seeing comments along the lines of Article 13 could change the internet as we know it.
That's right. So it's part of a larger directive that the European Parliament voted on this week, and the whole point of it is to update their copyright laws. But this one clause, Article 13, has been really controversial.
Why is it so controversial? What does Article 13 actually do? What does it say?
Basically, what it means is that platforms like Facebook and YouTube would have a whole new set of responsibilities to stop users from uploading copyrighted content. So, like, any popular song is copyrighted, any movie is copyrighted. And to explain what Article 13 would actually do, I want to turn to the most watched YouTube video ever.
Oh, I know what this is.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be stuck in my head all day. So this music video of Despacito is actually what YouTube's CEO pointed to in an open letter last year as an example of what the unintended consequences of Article 13 might look like. So she wrote that in order for YouTube to host this music video in the first place, they had to enter into licensing agreements with all sorts of people who have rights to different parts of the footage, different parts of the music, and so on. But for some things in the video, the license holders are unknown. She doesn't specify exactly what those things are, but, you know, it could be a piece of art in the background. And she wrote that under Article 13, it's possible that YouTube would have to block this video because they don't have licensing agreements for every single little thing. And on top of that, YouTube would have to figure out a way to detect that in the video before it even goes up. So right now, the way it works is that, you know, people who own the rights to, say, a song kind of have to police these platforms to make sure that people aren't using their stuff illegally. And then they report it to YouTube. YouTube would take it down. But under Article 13, YouTube would have to detect that violation and stop it before the video ever even makes it on its site.
Yeah, I mean, how would that even work? Because it starts to sound really complicated.
Yeah, well, presumably they'd have to use something called an upload filter, which is basically like a screening system that runs through what's being uploaded. And there's a problem with using technology like that. Here's Kathy Berry, an intellectual property lawyer in London.
Because this technology is not necessarily as nuanced or has the same understanding of what exemptions apply to copyright as a human would if they were reviewing it, then there definitely is a potential for impact on open internet and freedom of speech.
So using copyrighted material for things like parody, for criticism, for educational reasons is legal. But imagine how difficult it would be for an automated system to tell the difference between something that's parody and something that's not.
Right.
And just think about how much of the stuff that's out there on the internet is just that, like remixes and parodies. So lots of people are really worried about, you know, false positives that and what this technology could do to the internet as a whole. And this is why this has been called the meme killer law, although I don't think we should be worried it's going to kill all memes. And just one note here that in the end, it's going to be a lot of the smaller companies, so not the YouTubes, not the Facebooks, that probably feel this the most, because they may not have, you know, the money, the means to enter into all the licensing agreements that they need to host certain content. And they might not be able to develop or buy the technology that's needed to screen all the content that goes through their sites or to hire the people to do it manually.
You know, this is fascinating, Lydia. You'll recall that just yesterday we had the European Commissioner for Competition on the show, and she was talking about some of the moves that Europe has made to regulate the tech giants like Google and Facebook. For the most part, Europe's been praised for cracking down on them. Articles 13, though, seems somehow different. Who supports this?
Right. A lot of creative agencies, record labels, artists, they're really excited about this. And even critics of Article 13 will tell you there's a real problem with copyright infringement, with people using stuff they're not supposed to, and with artists not getting paid properly for their work. That's something I heard from this Swedish streamer I spoke with. Her name is Gabby. And this is how Gabby makes her living, streaming and posting videos of herself playing video games like Fortnite.
Nice gig.
Yeah, I know. On YouTube and this other platform called Twitch.
It's really important that people start respecting boundaries of using someone else's content. I mean, you can't just go copying others' items. And I think that's being done very much at the moment. However, I don't think that this is the solution to it. I feel like it's just a way of putting shackles on people instead.
So people like Gabby think this Article 13 is a bit misguided and that the unintended consequences are going to outweigh the benefits here. And consequences, by the way, Marco, that we here in the U.S. will likely feel as well, because even though this is an EU directive, it might not be possible for these multinational companies to only apply these rules to EU countries.
Right. It occurs to me kind of the same sort of thing that happened with some of the privacy protections they implemented in Europe recently, the GDPR.
Right.
We saw that here in the U.S. Exactly. I got to check that little box on
exactly.
Your website. So when does this all go into effect?
So next it goes to the European Council for another vote. It's expected to pass. And then every EU member state is going to have a couple years to implement it.
The World's Lydia Emanuelito, thanks very much for this primer on Article 13.
Thanks, Marco.
A memorial service was held today in Christchurch, New Zealand, to honor the 50 people killed in the mosque shootings there 2 weeks ago now.
Inna Allah 'Alim Khabir.
About 20,000 people gathered to pay their respects. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern addressed the crowd.
Racism exists, but it is not welcome here. Violence and extremism in all its forms is not welcome here.
Here in the U.S., there was an echo last week of the violence in Christchurch. Someone set fire to a mosque in Escondido, California, near San Diego, and left behind graffiti that referred to the attack in New Zealand. Dustin Cron leads the San Diego branch of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. I asked him what had happened.
So there were a group of worshippers actually staying the night in the mosque in a form of spiritual retreat. And around 3 a.m., they started to smell some petroleum outside the mosque, really strong smells of petroleum. So they went outside and they saw these people who had sprayed something on the mosque and were trying to light the gasoline on fire. And then they ran away. And so essentially they scared them away and then they put out the flames against the mosque. And it was because they were staying the night in the mosque that they were actually able to put out the fire.
How is the community in Escondido doing, Muslim and non-Muslim alike?
It was actually a really beautiful gathering that night where there were about 250 people who came out, a large group of Muslims. But really, it was a lot of people from the neighborhood, a lot of people crying and just saying how sorry they were that the community has to go through this. And so it was a good interfaith moment, a form of group healing where the community was saying we're stronger than hate. And the central mosque in San Diego, the Islamic Center of San Diego, had so many flowers that it literally looked like a flower shop. Hundreds and hundreds of hundreds of bouquets of flowers delivered over the period of the first week after the Christchurch massacre.
After the massacre in Christchurch, do you feel people in San Diego and the area are more scared now?
I mean, as Muslims, we believe in God and we believe that our destiny is with God. And so I don't think people are necessarily fearful. The mosques were as packed as they always are the Friday after Christchurch. And so I think that people have a heightened sense of awareness that white supremacists may want to attack Muslims, but that we believe that we'll protect our congregations and we'll stand as a community and we'll stand with our interfaith allies.
Here in the Boston area, we've noticed an uptick in security at mosques. I just saw a Cambridge police cruiser in front of the masjid in my neighborhood. To your knowledge, how is mosque security adjusting on the West Coast, especially since the Christchurch attack?
Yeah, there's been large police presence at mosques around the San Diego area, especially post-Escondido. A lot of congregations are also having conversations about how they protect themselves, the type of security systems they have in place. People have considered hiring armed security guards as well.
You're actually at a conference, a CARE conference, Dustin, in Washington. How are the people there, the attendees, kind of talking about this? What's the conversation like post-Christchurch and this new kind of concern?
We really believe the time is now to eradicate Islamophobia in the United States and to really go on the offensive. We have to start naming names. One of the things that was really interesting is who didn't show up for us in San Diego post-Christchurch, right? There was no call from the mayor of San Diego. There was no calls from a number of Congress people's offices. And it's like, even if you may have certain political leanings, you still can't reach out to a community in the midst of pain and suffering. And so we really, it's time for us to go on the offensive.
I mean, it sounds like you're kind of acknowledging a divide in this country. And I'm wondering, naming names, what will that do? Because it sounds almost antagonistic.
Right. It's antagonistic. But what are we supposed to do? Allow hate speech to continue to exist? At the end of the day, this isn't about anti-Semitism. It's not about Islamophobia. It's not anti-Sikh or anti-Hindu violence. It's not about anti-blackness when each of our congregations have been attacked. This is about white supremacy, and we have to be strategic as to how we eradicate white supremacy in the United States.
Dustin Cron, the executive director of the San Diego branch of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
We've been seeing a lot of news items this week about problems women face when they travel alone. So we asked you to tell us your stories about the good and bad of being a woman traveling solo. And we got a lot of responses.
Hi, my name is Brenda Gerard. I travel alone because there's no other voice I'd like to hear other than my own voice at the end of the day of exploring.
Hey, PRI and Marco. Coco from Utah here. I go to a big city at least once a year by myself to see art.
I remember that in Bogota, I was treated like a queen. I was like treated like a senora, and there was so much respect for women of my age.
Three of our listeners there, Rhonda, Coco, and Beth, Joining me now in the studio are the world's Lucy Martirosian and Allison Herrera.
Allison here. Hey, Marco.
Hey, Marco.
Lucy here.
Allison, Lucy, you put this call out to listeners to hear stories from solo women travelers, right?
Yep. And a lot of women agreed with Beth. They travel because they like the freedom. The safety question is interesting. Pam in Seattle says it's a concern for women whether they're traveling or not.
There's a critical point I'd like to make in this discussion, and it's that women face safety concerns all day long, every day, regardless of where we are.
To Pam's point, we heard from another listener who was attacked by a fellow American while she was in Amsterdam.
Yeah, and on the subject of safety while traveling, what are some of the differences you've been hearing about between what women and men experience when they're traveling?
Well, Teddy Anderson, she's from Salt Lake City. She said she felt like she was missing out on a lot of things that male travelers get to do.
The thing that always struck me is that the men who I was meeting traveling were having double the experiences I was having. They were having nightlifes. They would go out and have drinks with locals that they had met. And they would go on treks into the jungle with different local people, of course, mostly men.
Right. But then Teddy says that her perspective changed, that it's not just a conversation about men and women, but privilege around the world.
Now that I'm older, I realize that the real unfairness of traveling is that as an American and I was on a low budget, I still had enough money to go to countries and visit different places and meet different people who could not enjoy the same luxury of coming to my country on a low budget for them.
If you're just joining us, we're hearing some listener responses from women about why they travel alone and what it means to them. Allison and Lucy, what else did you hear?
Marco, listeners also told us that it's just really nice to be alone.
It's much easier for people to say yes to a single woman and her horse than to let a whole group invade your property.
I'm not on anyone else's clock, and it lets me stay a little bit truer to the things that I would like to do.
So I do not have to wait on others to go out to eat, look at things, or get involved in the culture.
Tourism in this way could be a vehicle to further friendship and understanding between nations, cultures, and seemingly different people.
That was Lexi, Jennifer, Aubrey, and Lisa reminding us that traveling alone is awesome. And that goes back to what we heard in the beginning.
These stories are really inspiring, and apparently travelers are calling us who drive, fly, and ride horses. They also remind us that women are more aware of safety than men. I mean, you have to be.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But people like Tori Sparks, for instance, won't let that stop her from traveling alone.
Post Me Too or pre Me Too, it doesn't matter how it's possible that we still have to be talking about these subjects, how it's possible a woman could be in danger just for choosing to walk down the street, daytime or nighttime, by herself.
By the way, that's the Tori Sparks, the musician. She's originally from Chicago, but she's messaged us from Barcelona.
I want to salute all the women travelers out there who do choose to travel alone, and the men as well, because, I don't know, we can't let anything stop us from discovering the world, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. Anyway, thanks to all of you who told us about your solo travels. Tori Sparks will actually take us out with her tune, Wade Into the Water.
In the water, children, wade in the water, 'cause God's gonna travel the water.
We'll leave it there. The world's Lucy Martirosian and Allison Herrera. Thanks for pulling this all together.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
For decades, people walking along the coast in the Finisterre region of western France have noticed a weird pattern, like really weird. Every once in a while, a bunch of plastic telephones wash up on the beach. Not just any phones, Garfield phones. The world's Amulya Shankar explains.
It's been 35 years that these Garfield phones have been washing up on the beach. I'm talking bright orange landline telephones shaped like the Monday-hating cartoon cat.
Oh boy, lasagna.
They've been a local symbol of plastic pollution in the ocean, but no one knew where they came from, until now. Thanks to a local farmer named Rene Morvan, he's lived near the beach his whole life. He remembers a bad storm in the 1980s when he was around 20 years old. That was when Garfield phones first started washing up all over the beach. He and his brother investigated at the time, but he forgot all about that. Until a local website ran a story that jogged his memory this year. Morvan got in touch with R. Viltansu, an anti-litter group, and shared his story. That led the team down a cliff, past slippery rocks, and into a cave that's only accessible at low tide. It turns out that a shipping container with hundreds of plastic Garfield phones was lost at sea in the 80s and got stuck in the cave. Must have been a Monday. Since then, every so often, the current sweeps a few phones to shore. Case closed. But the shipping container is buried under rocks and mostly inaccessible. So the people of Finisterre can look forward to many more years of Garfield phones on the beach. For The World, I'm Amulya Shankar.
Finally today, a story about the jazz scene in Washington, D.C., and how decades ago, two Turkish brothers helped shape that scene. Michaela Lafrak of station WAMU has more.
In 1935, two teenage boys from Istanbul moved to Washington, Ahmet and Nesui Ertegun, the sons of the new Turkish ambassador to the U.S., Mehmet Ertegun. They were big pop music fans, and in the 1930s, that meant jazz. They started going to the city's famous clubs, like the Howard Theater. They saw musicians like Duke Ellington.
They arrived waiting and anxious and wanting to, like, witness this music firsthand.
Georgetown University professor and jazz historian Anna Chalenza says the Ertegun's quickly noticed all the clubs were segregated. Audiences were either black or white, and musicians of different races rarely performed together. The Ertegun brothers weren't having it.
They began inviting the musicians that they admire the most to come and have lunch at the embassy, and that often then turned into performances.
They'd invite big names over, like Jelly Roll Morton and Duke Ellington himself.
Oh, I love it. See, this is perfect. So, you know, sitting around the table.
Chalenza shows me a photo from the time of the brothers and their guests eating together. About half the people in the photo are black, the other half white.
Saying, here is a safe space where you can perform together, and the color of your skin doesn't matter. That had a huge impact.
Neighbors complained about seeing black people going through the front door, but the ambassador stood up for his sons and the musicians. Today, the current Turkish ambassador, Serdar Kilic, lives in the same house with his family. It's an ornate mansion that dates back to World War I. He shows me the room where they used to hold the jam sessions.
They used to put tables over here. And chairs around them, and the stage is organized in such a way that it would hold all the jazz artists over there.
The concert room is empty now, save for a grand piano.
So are you a jazz fan yourself?
Not as much as Mr. Ertegun, I should say, but I'm keeping up with the tradition, as I told you.
The Ertegun brothers went on to organize what was probably D.C.'s first ever integrated concert at the Jewish Community Center on 16th Street in 1942. Maurice Jackson is a Georgetown University historian and the editor of a book on D.C. jazz.
The people at Jewish Community Center did not know it was going to be integrated. Blacks and whites just don't go to things together. And by the time it was all the publicity, it was too late.
Next, the Ertegun brothers helped desegregate the National Press Club. Blues guitarist Lead Belly performed. He went on to write this song, Bourgeois Blues, about D.C.
Ooh, living in a bourgeois town.
So one does not have to be a black person to appreciate jazz or promote jazz. And I don't think they set out to necessarily do this, but they saw injustice.
As adults, the brothers had a huge impact on the American jazz industry. Ahmet Ertegun co-founded Atlantic Records in 1947, and his brother joined a few years later. They produced records for John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, Ray Charles, and Aretha Franklin. And to think, it all started at the Turkish embassy in D.C. Here's Ambassador Cilic again.
We shouldn't forget the importance of this house in the cultural life of Washington, D.C. We are opening our doors, and I invite people to come and see it.
This residence made the news in 2017 when Turkish police attacked people who were there protesting the Turkish president. Cilic wants to get beyond that. Over the past few years, they've started hosting jazz concerts at the residence again. They're restarting the series on April 30th, International Jazz Day. For The World, Michaela Lafrak, Washington, D.C.
Michael Mwenso and his band performing in a live concert at the Turkish Ambassador's Residence back in 2013. Before we sign off today, a preview of a story we'll have next week on the show, an interview with Egyptian novelist Alaa Alaswani, author of the best-selling The Yacoubian Building. He's being sued by his country's military rulers, and he says the deck is stacked against him.
A military case in Egypt is totally decided by the president. It's totally useless, even if I send my lawyer.
And here's how Alaswani explains the political upheaval and repression in his native Egypt.
You can kill the people, but you cannot deprive the people of their dreams.
That story, Monday, here on The World. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. You have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.